Hello there, and welcome back to Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean, the podcast where we break down the movie American Splendor scene by scene, talk about Harvey Pekar, and discuss the joys and challenges of being professional cartoonists. I'm Josh Neufeld of joshneufeld.com.
And I'm Dean Haspiel of deanhaspiel.com.
And we have a guest with us today.
And my name is Alex Robinson from comicbookalex.com.
Thank you, Alex, for joining us for this, the penultimate scene, or actually, I guess, the final scene of the movie.
The ultimate scene.
It is ultimate. So this scene that we're going to be talking about is scene number 29, and it corresponds to chapter 21 of your DVD. And it starts at the 1 hour, 31 minute, and 12 second mark and ends 6 minutes and 20 seconds later at 1 hour, 37 minutes, and 32 seconds. And this is it. This is the end of the movie.
And it's actually a whole bunch of scenes. And in fact, it's almost like 6 episodes for Alex.
Yeah,
of
that's
his
true.
Podcast.
Thank you for joining us for the whole week, Alex.
That's right.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I guess what I wanted to do just before we get into the actual scene is just to ask Alex your general thoughts on the movie, just because it seems silly for us to discuss the very end of the movie before you've gotten a chance to weigh in on your thoughts about it in general from, you know, what you remember from when you first saw it or when you've seen it recently.
Watching the clip to prepare, that was the first time I'd seen any of it for a long time. I saw it when it first came out in the theater, and then I bought it on DVD. I remember liking the movie. I think I remember liking almost more that it, just that it had been made, as opposed to like, oh, this is a movie I want to watch over and over again. Just the fact that a good movie was made about Harvey Pekar, that alone exceeded all the expectations. So yeah, I thought the movie was great, and I like the comics better, but you know.
Okay, cool. But you have good feelings about it, and you bought it on DVD, which says something.
Yes.
All right, cool. So just to recap what happens here, I'm going to do like a really quick recap, and then maybe what we'll do is we'll go over each scene, you know, little by little.
That's a good idea, yeah.
So it opens with one of our patented comic book captions. 1 year later, Harvey and Joyce are signing copies of Our Cancer Year, and then we move on to another scene where Harvey gets the all clear from his doctor that he has no more cancer. And in the next scene, Harvey and Joyce are ice skating with Danielle, and we learn that they've taken her in to raise her. And then we move along to Harvey and Danielle are hanging out at home while she looks through old issues of American Splendor. And then we have a scene where Harvey walks Danielle to the school bus. That's the final appearance of Paul Giamatti's Harvey. Then we have a real Harvey voiceover talking about how this is not exactly a sunny, happy ending and what his life is like now. And we transition to the real Harvey walking down that same street. And finally, it ends with a surprise party slash retirement party at the VA hospital where Harvey's real co-workers appear and celebrate him. And we also see the real Danielle for the first time in the movie. And the final shot of the film is a shot of our movie year comic, which includes a picture of the writer-directors Sherry Springer Berman and Bob Puccini. And it actually is of a comic that at that point had not yet appeared. So let's go back now and go over those scenes in detail. So we go back now to back to the sequence at the comic book store where now they're signing. It's 1 year later. They're signing Our Cancer Year. And there's a real Harvey voiceover who's talking about the success of the book and how it won 2 National Book Awards. Actually, I could only find that it won the 1995 Harvey Award.
Hmm.
Which, again, was not named after Harvey Pekar. Still doing research to find out who those awards are actually named after. And that was supposed to be a joke. And
I'm waiting.
Okay, just keep waiting
for the joke.
Harvey Comics, obviously.
Well, you're right, yeah. Casper, Richie Rich. Exactly.
Hot stuff.
They were hot stuff.
That's right. No, I guess we're going to go, can we break it down a little by small, right, as we go through the 6 minutes, right?
Let's do it.
So, yeah, it's 1 year later. Clearly, they produced this book, and it's actually doing really well. And it's almost on their own terms. It doesn't involve David Letterman show. It doesn't involve other media. It's back in the roots. It's in a comic book shop. You know, we haven't seen a comic book shop, if I'm correct, really, since Joyce was looking for that missing issue of American Splendor. There's a little moment, I believe, where they're signing and R. Crumb starts riding the back of a girl for a moment, and I forget which scene that was.
Yeah, that was back near the halfway through the movie, and that was at a Crumb signing.
At a Crumb signing.
Yeah, that they went to.
But now, in a way, this is the first time we're seeing him sign comics. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of looking at everyone with a little bit of suspicion, like that's how Paul Giamatti like portrays Harvey, which is really funny. And Harvey does have that look inherently on his face. That's like his resting bitch face, is him being suspicious of people, which Paul adopted and adapted. Mm-hmm. But it's also a really kind of solemn and kind of beautiful moment. It's like, they went through this really tough time and they were able to turn it into art, you know, and now people are responding. In fact, it's a lot of people are at this signing. Yeah. More people than I've ever had.
I mean, there's some people who seem to be just standing there and watching, like they're not even online for the book. They're just kind of gawking, mm-hmm. kind of standing mm-hmm. around. And there's like a really happy guy who's hobbling around on crutches. They're like, we need a guy on crutches. Every comic book signing has one of those. Yeah. And Harvey's just very perfunctory in his signing. Like, he just signs the book, doesn't really look at anybody, you know, passes on to the next one, where Joyce is being a little friendlier and mm-hmm. talking mm-hmm. to people and also trying to, like, upsell people to buy the T-shirts and so forth. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys know, but so there's a guy sort of in the foreground with his back to the camera that is, like, the first guy that gets his book signed, mm-hmm. this gray-haired gentleman wearing, like, a suede coat. And that's actually Gary Dumm, who's one of Harvey's longtime illustrators. So he got into the movie as a patron.
Cool. I think I actually noticed an artist in the very last part of this 6-minute scene as well, but we'll get to that later.
We'll get there, Pop. Oh, wrong show.
What are you talking about? What is that? What was Pop? What show are you talking about?
It's a little show called Godfather Minute that our guest boy. Does.
I guess you give him props to Pops.
Pop props.
Treat him with respect.
All right.
So one thing I noticed is that they never show Frank Stack's name as the illustrator of the book. So there's like a little close up of Our Cancer Year, but it cuts off the bottom part where it would have showed his name, because of course there's this whole conflation of this Fred character, who's Danielle's real father, who thus takes the place of the real artist Frank Stack. They didn't want to lie and say that it was drawn by Fred. They just don't show who did the art at all.
Did we ever find out what Frank thought of that?
Yeah, I did find an interview that came out around the movie where he was pretty annoyed about the whole thing. Like, he had not been consulted and he didn't appreciate being represented as a drug addict, among other things.
But he had cool tattoos. Sorry.
He did. He's a good looking guy.
They didn't check with him. They didn't say, is that okay if we do it? That's weird.
I know. I think that since Harvey always made a point of owning the sole copyright on all of his comics, that it was kind of like up to him about things like that. And I'm sure it wasn't his choice, but it was the filmmaker's choice.
We broke it down and kind of reasoned why it was a smart move for the movie, you know, version. But you would think, because he is a substantial character and anybody could go pick up Our Cancer Year, that they would have at least told him and consulted in some way. Uh-huh. You know? So, I mean, I guess we can ask the directors about that and Ted Hope, the producer.
And hopefully we'll have Frank on, or we will have already had Frank on.
Oh, okay.
And he might have told us.
Right. All right. That's true. That's what editing
this
is all
podcast,
about.
You know, we go back and forth in time a lot.
So was there any kind of any notes or feelings about this scene? Alex, do you have any?
Well, the only question I had was, do you guys know where this was filmed? Which comic shop?
Okay, great question. And I did find that there were 3 comic book shops which were mentioned as locations in the film. Mm-hmm. And I believe all of them were in Cleveland or Lakewood, which is where a lot of this movie was filmed. So I'm wondering if that one was Collector's Warehouse on Madison Avenue in Lakewood, Ohio. But I was not able to confirm that.
There should be a Harvey P. Carr tour if there's not already. You know what I mean? Like Sex in the City, where you go, oh, look, that's the VA hospital. And oh, look, that's the...
Yeah.
That's where he was upset over there.
That's where he yelled at that woman about
that's
this
where he
thing.
Got oh, Dale yeah, Bread over there.
Hey, well, that might get people in. I mean, you know, I'm a fan of Dale Bread. Dale Donuts.
That's actually a good idea. Mapping P. Carr.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, the success of this podcast will spur that to start happening.
Do you think this is a good time to ask Alex about a certain question about Box Office Poison, or later?
I don't know. What do you think, Alex?
Let's get it over with. Everyone's waiting for you to ask, so you might as well just get it over
all
with.
All right. Well, here it comes. In Box Office Poison, you mm-hmm. have a character named Jane Pikar, who's yes. a cartoonist.
Yes.
Was the name influenced by Harvey Pikar?
Yes, partially.
Okay.
It was in honor of Harvey Pikar, but I also had an aunt whose last name was Pikar, so it kind of really? Did it kind of did double duty there.
Wow. So you're related to Harvey Pikar.
Well, I actually, one of my first interactions with Harvey Pikar was I sent him a letter and said, oh, I'm a big fan of your comics. And then I said, you know, I explained that my aunt had the same last name. Is there any chance they were related? And he wrote back and said, basically, unless she was a Polish Jew, or unless she was a Jew from a certain part of the area, probably not, because it's a very common name. And the fact that my aunt was from Poland, probably, they probably were not related.
So it had to be a specific area to be related, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess if they lived in the same, you know, village or something, that might have been a better clue than
right.
entirely different. Right, right. You know, it is, it's not, and he said it basically means baker.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so it's basically a common, the same way baker is.
Why did I not know that?
I don't know.
Because like, you just don't yeah, do the work, Josh.
I don't care enough.
You don't care, it's clear.
That's interesting that it means baker. That's such, yeah, that's such a basic
yeah.
word.
Huh? Yeah.
And I don't know if we want to get too much into it, and obviously, folks listening to this podcast, definitely look up Alex Robinson's career. He's got a great, great many graphic novels. And I discovered Alex's work through Antarctic Press when
yeah,
he was doing
Box
Office Poison, the comic book, that then got later collected by Top Shelf into the graphic novel in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the story is about this cartoonist and then another cartoonist who I believe is loosely based on a conflation of, I would say, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee with this character Irving Flavor. Is that kind of right?
Yeah, not so much Stan Lee, but I mean, at the time there was a few, you know, old timer artists who were, you know, Siegel and Shuster and Kirby and, mm-hmm. you know, those guys. So it was kind of like an amalgam of a lot of different pieces.
And the ones that had been basically wronged, let's say, in layman terms in the comics industry, where they had created characters for a company and then the company owned it.
Yeah.
Kind of situation. And that's part of the story in Box Office Poison.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, here's a little funny tidbit. Irving Flavor's comic book is called Night Stalker. And one of my, maybe my very first character I ever did was a character called Night Stalker.
Wow.
Yeah, you were about 15?
Something like that.
Yeah. What was his catchphrase?
He didn't really speak English. He just said absurd words. And one of them was Ingi Wamba. So there you go.
A classic of the four.
I can already see that little copyright sign next to that when it's on pajamas.
And a little TM at the same yeah. time. Why not? I remember picking up that comic at a comic book shop.
I love that comic.
Oh my God. It's like, it was a cross between like semi-autobio and then comics and then like, you know, romance comic. I just love that. That's
and very true to New York yeah. too.
Absolutely.
Like, only could have been done by a native New Yorker.
Absolutely.
It's very kind of you guys to say. I get very uncomfortable when people pay me compliments. So.
Well, then you can
good,
just pay
good.
Us compliments and reverse engineer.
Oh, you guys
this.
Are cool. You guys are.
We're
you guys
so
are
cool.
Now
you're
I'm,
awesome.
Now thank I'm feeling you. Very awkward.
Also, yeah. You went to SVA, and some of your teachers were Will Eisner, Carmen Infantino, Gahan Wilson,
Gene Colan.
Mm-hmm. Gene Colan, really? Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Gene Colan was definitely a partially an inspiration for Irving Flavor. I could say that now that he's no longer among the living.
Really? But, okay, I see that.
Yeah, because at the time I got into like arguments with him because SVA at that time was really just kind of like a training school. And like, here's how to be a mainstream superhero artist. You know, all the
yeah,
teachers mm-hmm. mostly reflected that. So, and at the time I was all like young and cool. And I was like, I like stuff like Love and Rockets, man. And
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
he never heard of Love and Rockets. He knew nothing about the alternative comics industry and seemed to think it was kind of pathetic that I was like aspiring to do a job where your best thing is maybe 5,000 people buy your comic.
Not totally wrong. Not totally wrong. Not totally wrong.
Well, you'll be yeah. happy to know, Alex, because I teach at SVA now that the mm-hmm. faculty is totally the other way. Like, I don't think that there's a mainstream artist involved in regular faculty there anymore. It's all alternative and literary folks. So
yeah, it makes sense because that's what gets the parents to write the checks.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
Oh, graphic novel. I read about those in the New York Times as opposed to like, you want to draw Doc Savage?
Well, or to keep it more on message with American Splendor, which is about mm-hmm. autobio comics. I love, love, love the amount of 21-year-old children coming out of comic book college to do their memoirs. Totally makes sense
hey,
to
man.
Me.
They've lived. They had their teens.
That's right. That's right.
I'm just a grumpy old man.
Well, I seem to remember our generation had its share of people in their 20s literally doing comics about masturbating. So, our generation is not immune to those.
That's true. That's true.
We were young and silly once, too.
All right. So should we hop to the next scene?
Yeah. So the next scene is when Harvey gets the good news that he's clear of cancer. And I was listening to the director commentary, and they were talking about how the whole movie was filmed where they flashed the film stock to give the movie kind of a grainy, washed out, brown, hazy effect. And that starting with this scene, they stopped doing that. And so it's like crystal clear. And I guess it's a metaphor for maybe how Harvey saw the world and how it changed after the events.
Gloom and doom, and then there was a moment of clarity once he was able to get beyond, like, maybe the cancer was part of the doom and gloom. Although, in his narration throughout the rest, that is the real Harvey Pekar.
We're back to doom and gloom.
He acknowledges some of the good things that have happened, but he can't help himself. He's like, it's really tough. And I know I've talk like that myself, even in interviews, you know, like even when we're celebrating something, I can't help but continue to acknowledge, like, literally a few inches to the left is horror.
It is.
You know, like, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Our doom is right around the corner. And also the apartment itself just kind of is like looks brighter and more colorful and less cluttered than all those previous scenes, even though I assume it's the same place.
Well, there's a sound. There's a very strange sound coming from when he gets the phone call and he hangs up. You hear the sound of happiness.
What's that?
Joyce and Danielle are kind of giggling and playing with each other. And I think what they're doing
like arts and crafts.
They're creating little necklaces, you know, with beads and stuff like that. And he turns around and there's this moment before he tells Joyce, like, it's all clear. It's all good. You know, I'm clear. He's watching her be happy. And that also helps kick in the narration from the real Harvey acknowledging it as well.
But there's just something so funny about him delivering good news. Like, it's so rare that he has expressed optimism or happiness that his face looks like it almost kind of breaks a little bit. And then Joyce, when she's listening to him, like, she also just doesn't seem able to process good news.
She covers her mouth with her hand.
Yeah. I mean, I understand it's a very subtle bit of acting from Hope Davis.
And then Danielle jumps up and hugs Harvey.
Yeah, which was very cute. Okay, so now here's where we need the music from your show, where the book is different from the movie, because in reality, Danielle came into Harvey and Joyce's life far after our cancer year.
Right.
Like, Harvey had cancer in like 1990, 1991, and Danielle appeared in their life like around 1998. And he talks about that decision to adopt Danielle in a story called Interviewing the Interviewer in American Splendor Bedtime Stories from 1999, which was illustrated by Frank Stack. So all of that actually happened at least 4 years after our cancer year actually came out. And I just had a little bit of information about the actress who plays Danielle. Did either of you guys recognize her from anything?
She looks familiar.
Alex?
Let me look at her again.
Her name is Madeline Sweetin.
Oh, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah, so I don't know if either of you ever saw Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah.
The TV show. I never saw it. You've seen it, Dean?
It's actually really good.
Is it a good show? So she's the eldest child of Ray Romano's character on that show. And she was on that show for like 9 seasons.
Right.
And her two younger twin brothers are also on the show, and they play her twin younger brothers on the show. So she was a longtime TV actress, and this was filmed sort of like halfway in the run of that. And she's still acting, but not really having a ton of success after Everybody Loves Raymond. It's That's Madeline Sweetin.
Very few people, I think, when they've embodied a character for so long, can have another career. Like, I'm think of, and why am I blanking on the actress's name, who played Elaine on Seinfeld and then Veep?
Oh, Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
Right. Like, she was able to make the leap.
Yeah.
You know, apparently. And then there was, what's his name, who did Breaking Bad and Charles in the Middle? Something. Malcolm in the Middle.
Charles was in charge.
Charles was in charge. Malcolm was in the middle.
Yeah.
And then one of them broke bad.
Well, yeah, when you're stuck in all these old places.
That's right.
Yeah, most people get one shot at it, especially if you're a child actor.
And this is fascinating. You guys are going to love this. So on Everybody Loves Raymond, she plays Allie Barone, I guess, or Barone. Is that the name? And in this movie, she plays Danielle Batone.
Wow. And that was a made-up name, right?
Which one?
Batone. Well, obviously, they were both made up. But...
No, that's her real name.
No, her real name is Batone.
Yeah.
Batone. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Her character.
Because she's a real person.
That's weird. Maybe that's how she got the part.
Yeah.
They figured she was close.
Used to that sort of name.
That's not how it works, guys.
Syllable.
She wouldn't be confused if someone said, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. I'm so used to playing that from a movie into a 9-season television show. Guys. All right. And I did notice that the music throughout a lot of this last 6 minutes is kind of melancholic.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little kind of bright
back
moments.
Back to the woozy jazz.
But it gets
a little
woozy
bit.
Jazz again, you know? And then there's this cut to an ice skating rink.
Yes.
And Harvey is watching Joyce and Danielle ice skate. And then the real Harvey states, you know, with his narration, that the weirdest thing that came out of his illness was Danielle.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing her.
So he's saying she's weird.
Nope. Not funny. That it was weird that.
He gets so irritated.
You continue. I'm flummoxed right now.
So the reason why the ice skating thing was because the real Danielle's actually like a pretty accomplished ice skater, apparently, and won some ice skating trophies and so forth in her tween years.
But the way they play the scene is that she is bonding with Joyce, Danielle.
Yes.
And then again, Harvey's kind of observing and watching this.
Right.
And I think it's
from
building
afar.
Up to a very quiet idea that's never spoken. And I'll continue as we continue the scenes. I'm going to get to this point that I want to make.
Okay.
Because there's a very, they devote a few seconds per scene of just Paul Giamatti's portrayal of Harvey watching and observing mm-hmm. this relationship kind of grow.
Well, I have to say I've become like that when it comes to ice skating because I used to ice skate like when I was in my teens. And for some reason in my adult life, like ice skating is the most painful mm-hmm. thing that could possibly happen to my ankles. Mm-hmm. So I am now at the stage where I just eat cold pizza and watch my wife and daughter mm-hmm. ice skate. Mm-hmm. What about you guys? What is your ice skating history in explicit detail?
I think I've only went ice skating one or two times.
In your life?
In my life, yeah.
Wow. So you just avoid it when like people say, let's go skating? Or it just doesn't happen that much?
It just doesn't happen that frequently. I didn't do it till I was in like my mid-20s and I tried it a few times at the...
So that's awkward.
Yeah. And so I was like, meh. Well,
it's
and
hard
also,
to
I'm
pick it up when you're an adult.
I'm a clumsy oaf. I have enough time walking around on dry, flat land, let alone on frozen water. So, you know, I'm not fooling anybody.
Because I have the body and DNA of an Olympian, I actually did ice skate.
Really?
And roller skate to the point where I could do it backwards and sideways and all that stuff. And then when I fell off a 3-story building at age 21 and broke both my legs, my lower back and my right hand.
I'm not laughing at you.
Uh-huh. I did not do any of that until I would say a few years ago. My girlfriend Jen was like, let's go ice skating in Lower Manhattan somewhere. And it was an outside thing. And we went and it was the worst thing I could have ever done.
Was it the ankle thing?
Ankle pain.
Yeah.
Didn't have the stamina, lower back. I mean, it's really core. It's all about that, that core, which I have none of anymore. I mean, I don't know how everyone on this podcast feels, but I know I sit way too much,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then I go from A to B on a bicycle once, you know, every day, but it's not real exercise. And yeah, it sucks. I was a little embarrassed of myself, you know?
Aww.
I mean, even though I'm getting older and all that, like there were grandmas ice skating around me.
That
you know?
Just crystallize like the slow decline of
it's
our,
the idea of, that I can't do something.
Right, something that you used to be able to do.
Before it'd be like, if you couldn't do it, you would learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I can learn how to ice skate again.
You can't teach an old Dean new tricks.
No new skills.
Nope, it's done. I know what I know.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to know less as I get older.
You know it. So one other note, Harvey takes out like a cold slice of pizza and chomps on it while he's watching them. And again, listening to the director's commentary, this is a pro tip, guys. If you want to know about a movie, you know, I'm just saying.
Just do some research.
Yeah. So Paul Giamatti said that was actually anchovy pizza and that they had ordered like a whole bunch for the crew and that nobody wanted to eat it.
That's
so
disgusting.
He happily ate it.
Yes.
So that was my questions were, what is your guys' policies on anchovy pizza and also cold pizza of any kind?
You go, Alex. You start.
You go.
No to anchovies.
Yeah.
And
same.
I guess some cold pizza, kind of like a classic thing. Is that really in dispute?
I just have never, I've never been able to do it. I always have to warm it up somehow, even though it never tastes as good as when you first got. I mean, to me, the only good slice of pizza is like a fresh
A dead pie. Slice of pizza.
A de- But yeah, I can't eat a cold slice of pizza.
What's your favorite topping?
Pepperoni. Very simple. It's just... You like...
My favorite, I think, topping to a slice is onion and garlic. And I've actually had a slice in the Catskills that also incorporated a little drizzle of pesto, as well as sesame seeds on the crust, which was key. Really good stuff.
That doesn't sound bad.
Yes, obviously we've all eaten cold pizza. That's leftover pizza, man. You know, that's how you eat it.
No, you warm it up.
And I do like a good sausage once in a blue.
Ain't it?
But pepperoni just, it gives me... Was it agita or whatever? Or give me some good Jewish word like verklempt or something. Like
verklempt pizza.
Verklempt pizza. I'll eat it if I have to, but
it's
I'm not a fan.
It's artisanal.
It's almost like fried bologna.
Yeesh.
So, Alex, what's your favorite slice?
I'm like, well, I'm not actually that big of a pizza guy. So I just, when I get it plain. Nothing exotic.
Yeah. So that's one of the things you don't miss particularly about New York, I'm guessing.
No, I do not. Okay. And Portland supposedly does not have very good pizza, so pick the right city.
I don't have pizza as much as I used to, that's for sure, but I still love it. The skating rink where they're at, I'm sure you guys want to know, that's the Cleveland Halloran Ice Rink at 3550 West 117th Street. And amazingly, it's one of the few locations that is still operational in this movie, because we've discovered as we've been doing it that many of the locations no longer exist, filming locations, and this movie's not even that old. What can you do?
Is this ice skating rink, did they just use it for the movie, or is this also where the real Danielle went skating?
That's a good question.
I just wonder if we should add it to the tour or not.
I think it should be added, but yeah, we'd want to find that out. Either way, though, it should be added.
Especially
to the
since
tour.
It's one of the few places still open, I guess probably should add it to the tour.
You can't be too picky.
Let's get going, too.
All right, so shall we move on to the big scene on the futon with all the issues of American Splendor?
That was a great scene.
Sure.
I like that scene.
Why did you like it, Dino?
It kind of shows for the first time Harvey and Danielle connecting.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a little dispute almost, and she holds her own.
Yep.
And I think he likes that. And even though they disagree, it bonds them. Harvey and Danielle are in the bed reading, you know, American Splendor comics, because what else does he have, right? And she seems to be reading the comic book backwards, you know, from the back page towards the first page. And Harvey calls her out on that. And she says she likes reading backwards. And this worries Harvey. And he wonders why. Oh, no. She gets worried and wonders why Harvey is drawn so ugly.
Yeah. She says, like, he looks like a monster or something.
Right. And he says, well, wait till you see how your face looks in the comic. And she's like, well, what are you talking about now? And he's like, well, now you're part of the story. And she goes, what story? He goes, the story of my life. And she sighs and, you know, remarks, I may not. Oh, and he remarks, because she sighs and she's kind of like a little disgruntled. And he goes, well, listen, I may not be into the Little Mermaid or any of that magical stuff. And she claims that she's going to write her own comics, but not about Harvey.
And he actually seemed to like that. Like, he kind of respected that she was a nascent storyteller on her own.
Right. But also, he does, in the next scene, kind of pushes her again toward leaning towards doing memoir type stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was just a really cool scene. It locks you in because you see the relationship with Joyce, but you don't really see the relationship with Harvey because he's been hesitant. He's been kind of hovering around like a bird, like trying to figure out this Danielle person. And he respects what it does to the home and what it does for Joyce, and obviously what it's doing for her to have this kind of regularity, this home base, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But he is not like a, you know, not like a hawk, but he's trying to figure it out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that how he does it is by relating through the comics. They're able to relate to each other through comics in some way, at least in the movie version.
But he's ready to take off at any minute, because if you notice, when he's lying there on the futon, he's got his shoes on, which is not what you normally do when you lie on a bed or a couch.
You know,
so it's like he's ready to run up and jump and run away as fast as he can.
But think about that. That's like the privilege of a king. You know, if you're able to like lie on your bed with your shoes on, that's like top of the rung, man. Like, you've made it.
That always bugs me when movies and TV shows do that kind of thing. When they'll have someone kind of like, you know, like that. Or like if someone's sleeping and then they're wearing their glasses while they're sleeping. Come on.
What about back in the day when they had to have 1 foot on the ground and in separate beds?
Yeah, right.
The Hays Code.
Because that meant they weren't having sex at all.
Yeah, well, I wonder how the Hays Code and the Comics Code like came into conflict in this scene where they have comics on the bed and two people on the bed without both feet on the ground.
Total blasphemy.
Yeah. Yeah. This would not have passed.
So I have a question for you guys about this
bit.
So I can't tell if Harvey is reading An American Splendor or not. It looks like there's an ad on the back, and that doesn't sound like something that was on American Splendor. But
yeah, I was looking at that too, and I was thinking it was probably like a jazz magazine or something.
Okay, that's good. Because I was going to ask you how often you guys sit around reading your own comics.
Reading your own comics.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a painful experience to even look at my own comics. I certainly don't sit down to read them.
I mean, feel that same way about your work.
Thank you.
Maybe because he doesn't draw it, he doesn't have to worry about that part. So he can
say,
oh.
That's true. Though he might be like, oh, why did I go on and on for the 2 pages about day-old bread? There have been times I've actually had to sit down and read a comic because... Oh, this is such a humble brag. So a few of my books have been used in schools as like, you know, first year experience, freshman year joint, you know, like everybody reads the same book and then discusses it. And they've invited me to come speak. And so there had been some years since between one of my appearances in that. And I was like, I need to read this book again. It was a book I had illustrated and not written myself. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of years had gone by, so I reread the whole thing just so I could really be, you know, familiar with it again. And it was difficult to look back at my own artwork. I assume you were just asking not a real question, and I answered it seriously. I'm sorry.
No, I was curious. Some people don't mind looking at their own stuff.
I'm working on a series right now called The Red Hook, and I'm in the third season, so I have to go look at older aspects of the previous chapters or stories or whatever to kind of, you know, for continuity and stuff. But I rarely look at my old stuff, and I too cringe, you know.
Really?
Of course.
Like stuff even just a few years ago?
I cringe at stuff. Also because, and we've discussed this maybe outside of the podcast, but I'm doing deadline art. I don't even know what my art looks like. Because I haven't given it, I don't have the, there's a clock attached to it that's just ticking, you know, and like, make the deadline. What about you, Alex? Like, how do you feel about your older work?
Ugh, I'm more like what you said. I would dislike most of the pages I did, but recently I've been doing more, less comics and more kind of like illustration based work. And I'm really enjoying that a lot more. Mm-hmm. It's so nice getting to draw something and not having to worry about having to draw that same thing over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You can just kind of go to town with as many details as you like and whatever, but
it's funny that there's a different, like, so I've had to, let's say it's like a cover or a single image like you're talking about, but then the other anxiety I have is, well, this is the only one time I'm going to draw the version of this thing I'm doing, you know, a person, a character, whatever, or characters, and then it just has to feel right. You know, because at least when you're doing a, you know, narrative or panel to panel, you can get it right sometimes, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true.
You ever consider revisiting your box office poison characters?
I have, but I have never been able to think of a good story that would get the gang back together. So
you did that little follow-up pamphlet comic, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That was me seeing if I could actually do it. And I was like, ugh, you know what? This is terrible.
No, I enjoyed it.
Oh, well, thank you. But I mean, it wasn't like I was like, oh my gosh, this is inspiring me to do so much more. It was just kind of like, ugh, like I'd rather do new characters that reflect my current interests than go back and do something like that. And also, like, I don't want to Matrix Revolutions this and come out with a crappy sequel that tarnishes the original, you know, one.
Yes.
Like, oh, did you know he totally came out with the second one? He revealed that all the characters, you know, it was a dream the whole time.
Right.
Something like that. So.
No, you don't want to do that. I guess it's a good opportunity to ask, because we're talking to Alex about his work. How did
this happen? What, I thought we were trying to talk about American Splendor.
No, I know, but I want to ask, how did American Splendor and Harvey Pekar influence your work, if at all?
He was a big influence. I first read, I remember American Splendor, I think it was number 4, And I read it when I got into SVA and I was in college. And it was the joke I always make is that it was like LSD in reverse, because it was kind of like showing you how the most mundane everyday things can be made into an interesting story. The one I always think of is Harvey's friend comes to visit him for a weekend, and he has a hard time coming up with stuff for them to do to fill the weekend. You know, and that's it. But that's such a common experience. Everyone who goes through it, and it, you know, that really made me, and I definitely went through a phase where I was like, I'm just going to do mundane stories that, you know, are kind of like little poems, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dean and I had that phase too. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is like when you're young, you want to try out like all these different kind of formalistic experiments and stuff to see, you know, what your comfort level is and just sort of where your skills can be best applied.
Yeah, so
it's hard to do the kind of stories that Harvey did and make them as effective as he did. There's kind of like a magic to it that I've never been able to figure out for sure.
Yeah, that's true. You haven't. Sorry, I just
he left himself.
No, I like. I know. Agree with.
After Dean got that one in, I was like, okay, Nick, I have to do it. I have to do it.
Got it. Thank you, Alex. I have an ally. All right, I have another question for Alex, but I want to ask later.
Okay. Do you guys think there's any significance to the fact that Danielle is reading the comics backwards? Like, she has like a philosophy of a commentary on life, but she likes to see things go in reverse. Or,
well, I think, when is that? What year is that supposed to take place?
That she was sitting there with
him?
I don't know. Whenever the book came out. But
91, let's say?
Well, the timeline of the movie is so, you know, different than real life. The real book came out in 94, but it seems to be implied that this was happening more like 1990, 1991.
Right. So how popular was manga? Because I was thinking maybe it was a wink to manga.
Oh. Interesting.
I mean, I don't know if the filmmakers thought that, but that's the first thing I thought of was the reason why I can't read a lot of
Manga.
When manga first came out, like Akira and Crying Freeman and a whole bunch of comics, they published it the American style, like left to right. But current manga, popular manga, is right to left. And I can't buy these books because I don't know how to do that. Do you read that kind of stuff, Alex?
You mean read it backwards the way the...
Well, meaning the current way they publish manga. Do you read manga comics at all? And if you do, the way they've been publishing in the last decade or so has been the way it's published in Japan, you know.
And, right.
And I just can't figure it out. I can't do it. It's too much of a struggle.
Because you have to read the page right to left, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't read that much manga. The ones I've read have been the way you describe. And it always takes me a while to get into it. I feel like once I start, if I read a bunch in a row, I can kind of get that rhythm going. Mm-hmm, but it is somewhat counterintuitive. You'll sometimes just read the page backwards. And even if you're reading the book backwards, you'll read the page backwards. And, you know, it's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But,
also, one of my good friends, Mike Houston. Was it Mike Houston?
Yeah, his name is pronounced Mike Houston.
No, or someone else that I know for a fact, I think it's Mike, will read the last page of a book first sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I was just talking to someone else who does that. I don't know if it's Mike, but I know other people who do the same thing.
And that's like a hate crime to me. What are you doing?
They just want to know that everything works out okay, and then they can read with more confidence.
I can't. Why do you craft story for
it? I don't do it either,
then?
But I do know that that is a thing.
That's horrible.
I've heard people say that too.
I think I want to do a book where the ending is
there's
not
like a fake
in the book.
Last page.
And you have to email me to get the last page.
You have to send in a proof of reading.
I remember reading some comics review and someone said that, I think it was like an Amazing Heroes or something. And they were saying that they said, people sometimes will just read the last paragraph of a review to see if the book is worth buying.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the whole review was trashing the book. And then the last paragraph was, you should pick it up. This book is really great to trick people who didn't read the whole review into buying a bad book.
I actually did that with homework. I don't know if you guys ever did this, but whenever I wasn't very good at in school. But when I did make the effort to write the little page and a half essay for the homework assignment, whatever it was.
Like the book report or just like the quick.
Whatever. And I get it back and it'd be a check. Like, I was like, did you read what I wrote? And everyone got a check. And this happened week after week. And finally, I remember one time, and I took a risk. I purposely wrote in the middle of it, like, fuck you, teacher. Like, I hate you, whatever kind of thing. And I came back with a check.
Oh.
And I was like, so I don't need to write it. It's just gibberish now. And then I didn't learn ever again.
Have you guys heard
that? Next scene.
Wait, one more story along those lines.
Okay.
You've heard the story about Van Halen wanting green M&Ms, right? You guys know that.
Yes.
Yes. The writer.
Right. Yeah, it's a similar thing. So,
well, tell real quick so for our listeners who don't know the story.
Oh, okay. So apparently when Van Halen was touring, they were one of the first huge bands to start touring in smaller venues. And they weren't sure if these people were, you know, up to the task of putting together their giant stage thing or whatever. So they put a thing in their rider saying they want green M&Ms in their dressing room before every show. And if they knew that if they got to their dressing room and there were no green M&Ms, that the people have not been reading the instructions carefully, and they put them on alert that, you know, it's to start cracking skulls. So
and all I can think of is like, what does the person look like that's actually separating the different color M&Ms and just picking out the green ones? And all I can think of is Josh Neufeld.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I like that image too, because then I'd get to eat all the other M&Ms, right?
Right.
Basically. Or is there another band that's asking for all the blue M&Ms and
brown?
Yeah.
Remember the tan M&Ms?
There was the whole thing was there no brown M&Ms, right? That was like the big
racist.
Racists. But I do remember was there ever a tan M&M?
It might have been one of those stunt ones. Yeah. Limited time, tan M&Ms.
That will really get the people in stores.
Yeah.
So there's this poignant moment in this scene where Danielle says to Harvey, I think you've done enough already. And I just can't help but feel that has so much more resonance now because, you know, obviously when this movie came out, Harvey was still alive, but he's since passed on. And I don't know, it's weird because like I can't help looking at the real Harvey in these scenes and seeing kind of how haggard and kind of
he looked a little mangled and rough actually. Yeah. And in fact, a lot of his own narration is a little prescient, I felt now seeing it years later. Like he was on the money in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So talking about being on the money and her saying, I think you've done enough already, this is just a quick list of all the books that Harvey wrote in the, how many years was it between this movie coming out and his death? 7 years, basically. And up to that point, he'd already published like 6 collections of American Splendor, basically, and then doing our cancer year. So after that, in those 7 years that he had left, he published American Splendor, our movie year, Best of American Splendor. Those two were the first ones that had some of my American Splendor work in them, by the way. The Quitter, with a guy named Dean Haspiel. Ego and Hubris, the Michael Malice story. Macedonia, American Splendor, Another Day, with DC Vertigo. Students for a Democratic Society, A Graphic History. American Splendor, Another Dollar, another DC Vertigo book collection. The Beats, A Graphic History. Studs Terkel's Working, A Graphic Adaptation. And then 4 more books came out after he died, which were Yiddishkeit, Jewish Vernacular in the New Land, Huntington, West Virginia on the Fly, Not the Israel My Parents Promised Me, and Harvey Pekar's Cleveland. And that doesn't even mention the Pekar Project, which we talked about with Jeff Newell. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of crazy. Like, I know we haven't gotten to discuss this, you know, where Harvey starts talking about how he's really got to press himself to keep it all together now that Danielle is added to the family and everything, but he obviously really did. Like, he was not joking. Like, he basically was just churning out scripts.
And according to Joyce, there's a bunch of...
There's even more.
Unillustrated stories that he's written. Mm-hmm. And they were also collaborating on, I think, 2 major graphic novels together that she also has material for. Mm-hmm. So,
and in that story I mentioned previously, interviewing the interviewer, he talks about how he was, like, getting up early in the morning to write, like, $15 a story, like liner notes for jazz albums, and just really like hustling like crazy, like after he had retired, which is just, it's just painful to contemplate that.
But he also got a lot out of it, because remember, he was kind of struggling and stumbling there during the Dark Horse years.
Mm-hmm.
Then the movie comes out and gets 3 books out of DC Vertigo, and then more work than ever afterwards. So
But then there's the question of the quality of it and whether it matched up to his earliest stuff, which, you know, is debatable.
I think there might have been a couple of potential duds, but I think in general it was up to snuff.
Okay.
When I think about, obviously the early comic books have that verve and snap and that kind of attitude that, you know, right out the gate. Mm-hmm. But it's not like he was trying to match that. He was just writing his life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Alex, did you continue reading his work for the whole breadth of his career, or was there a period where you weren't reading his stuff as enthusiastically?
I think there came a time where it was kind of I wouldn't do everything, I guess, towards the second half. A lot of it would depend on the artist, mm-hmm. and some of it would depend, like, you know, if I would hear about the subject matter. So I guess I got a bit pickier once I got...
What did you think of the comics that I drew?
I thought they were pretty cool.
Just kidding.
I thought you did a good job. I thought, I think the inking
was good.
You're
way too nice, Alex.
The perspective.
Way too nice.
Lettering was
the
solid.
The perspective was good.
Right. Yeah. Like he clearly never read a comic you drew.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Actually, now that I think about it, I would love to have seen a collaboration between you and Harvey, at least one story.
Yeah.
That's a bummer.
That ever something that you tried to make happen? Or
I think
or
I did. I think
about?
I had sent him, when I started doing Box Office Poison with Antarctic, I think I sent him some of my stuff and I said, oh, I would love to work with you and so on. But I regret that he did not take me up on it, but I didn't bear him any ill will. I wouldn't have hired me either. So,
well, things worked out pretty well for you. So,
yeah.
You know.
Well, you can't complain.
So should we move on to the school bus scene?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a recap of my recap?
Nope.
No, we're good. So yeah, my only note is the whole thing about her saying that he's holding her hands too hard,
mm-hmm.
and getting back to what Dean was saying about in the previous scene where he was actually kind of engaging and being a parental figure, it seems like he's now trying too hard or he's just still not comfortable with the whole thing.
I read it completely differently.
Really? But
yeah.
Also, in the director's commentary, they mentioned that Harvey, though he did not write the script, he had mentioned to them while they were working on the script that he used to be embarrassed of his father taking him to the school bus, which is what Danielle says, or Harvey infers that she's embarrassed of him. So that was like his own projection, but it was also kind of cool because it's actually something that actually authentically came from Harvey.
Yeah, he's holding her hand. They're walking toward the bus, and she does the usual, you know, what a lot of kids are like, you know, I'm embarrassed that, you know, my parents holding my hand kind of thing. And he infers that, like you said, and then she says, no, Harvey, you just hold my hand too tight.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I felt that it meant that Harvey really cared, was starting to really care for her.
That's how
he
I read
didn't
it.
Want to let her go. And then this is the silent kind of non-spoken thing. I wondered if he had regrets of getting a vasectomy.
Because, you know, you remember, Alex, from the movie that the very first thing he says
sure.
to Joyce when he meets her basically is like, I just want you to know I've had a vasectomy.
Yeah, I do remember that. I read it along the similar lines that Dean said, that he was, even if he wasn't consciously aware of it, he was, you know, on some level, really wanted to hold on to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I also got the thing of like, oh, you know, like regret about not having children sort of thing.
Interesting. Well,
and
it's two against one. See, you're probably right and I'm wrong.
Well, also because, Alex, you don't have children, right?
No, not that I'm aware of.
I have a biological daughter and I wouldn't consider myself a father proper,
uh-huh.
but Josh is a father and raises a daughter. So I think that when you become a father, you're not able to see that anymore in films when someone's being a father.
What? It's just like a blank space on the screen.
You don't see. You can't see, hear. You're just like, why are you holding your hand so tight, Harvey?
You don't remember what it was like to have the unconditional love of a child, to not have
mm-hmm.
that. You take it for granted. You take right. your children for granted.
Yeah.
And
do.
And he also has a hamster. That I think
I know that. No, I couldn't. Got a key. Your thing was going on with that hamster in the room.
And if I may add to this, there's also a solemn jazz music plays. The woozy jazz is happening through that scene. And then the real Harvey jumps back in with a narrative. And he basically admits that comics brought him a lot, is how he puts it.
Mm-hmm.
Brought me a lot. But he didn't want anybody to think that the movie had a happy ending, which is like, why are you telling me this before it ends? And what are you trying to say? And he said life was still tough and that he and Joyce fought like crazy.
And that Danielle has ADD.
Yeah, Danielle has ADD. Joyce barely works. Mm-hmm. His life is total chaos
mm-hmm.
as he's kind of like walking. And then as he's walking down the street, it transitions into the real Harvey walking down the street.
Mm-hmm. Which mirrors, of course, the beginning of the movie where we had the young actor playing Harvey who then turned into the Paul Giamatti Harvey who then turned into the real Harvey.
That's right. Nice little trope.
Very nice.
The circle. Circle of life.
I had something I was going to say about the school bus bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She goes to sit in the back of the bus so she can wave goodbye to Harvey as the bus is pulling away. And I don't know about you guys, but when I was a kid, the bad kid sat in the back of the bus. so I didn't know
yeah.
if the A, that was
Danielle.
Still going on. Josh, you have a child, I'm told. So do they sit in the front or the back of the bus?
The only school bus experience we had was a year that I spent in Michigan about 6 years ago on a fellowship. And so my daughter actually took a school bus, which was really fun for all of us. Because here in New York, it's either the subway or you walk to school. Right. Well, I mean, I guess there are school buses, but in our neighborhood, it's never been an option.
I almost get hit by a school bus every day on my bike. So they are there.
You get hit almost by a school bus?
Yes.
Not the other way around? You got to put that little stop sign out the side of your bike. That will save you.
So
the school bus thing, I don't think Phoebe ever sat in the back. I don't remember if the bad kids were back there. She was only in kindergarten. I don't think they had yet developed their villainy at that point.
I do agree that there is the bad kids sit in the back of the bus, but I think, don't forget here, this is cinema, mm-hmm. right? So if we're going to have Harvey Pekar longing and having feelings for this new daughter of his, if she just popped up in the front window, we wouldn't have that moment of him following her and walking towards, like, which is what happens, so he can be watching her and
right.
slowly letting go of letting her go to school. It was more for dramatic effect.
Also, I think it's a counterpoint to, so she sort of scolds him and says he's obsessive compulsive and that Joyce was right. And sort of like, we're like, oh, she's like a little mini Joyce. Like, she's already been trained in this sort of combative way of relating to Harvey. But then we see that she actually is very sweetly waves goodbye to him. And so there is still that love. And that, like, that's a kind of relationship that Harvey can understand. It would be very confusing and probably threatening to him if he had an uncomplicated relationship with somebody.
Right. And I think that's actually also what recommends Danielle, is the fact that she's influenced somewhat by Joyce, but also has this unconditional feeling in a way, you know? No, it seals the deal in a lot of ways. You know, like, you get it. He's in now. You know, he's kind of reversed the vasectomy by the fact that he can adopt Danielle and have a daughter.
Even though she's already getting into trouble.
Clearly.
And they make sure to mention that, too. So the other thing that was just kind of poignant and a little bit sad to me, but again, this might just be me, is that because Harvey had mentioned in the commentary about how his dad used to take him to the school bus and he was embarrassed by that, and here he is taking his foster child to the school bus and thinking about the long stretch of his life, that he had spent his entire life in basically that one place in Cleveland. And as someone who's moved around a lot my whole life, and I feel like I've benefited from living in Southern California and Northern California and Ohio and Canada and New York, obviously, like, I feel like that's been such a key component to what formed me as a human being, is that I've lived in lots of different places. I don't know, there just seems something really remarkable or interesting, or, yeah, I don't want to characterize it, but that he spent his whole life in Cleveland, never spent any significant time outside of that city or even that neighborhood.
I mean, I can identify with that because I've basically been a New Yorker. I've been lucky to travel certain places and gone out of the country a couple of times for a few days here or there or whatever. But I would basically say that what I know is Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Right. But for you, like, Manhattan was such a totally different place. And when you moved to Brooklyn, I remember it was a really big deal for you.
It was like moving to the country to a whole new... or something.
Yeah. I mean, Brooklyn was not the cool Brooklyn that it is now when you moved. And you were so, you had such an Upper West Side life.
Yeah.
And now you were moving to, well, I mean, and then you'd lived like a 14th Street area and so forth and downtown. And you, there's so many different neighborhoods. And also, let's be honest, Cleveland is not New York.
No.
Right. Technically true.
What about you, Alex? What's your living experiences? I've actually lived in 4 addresses.
Wow. In your entire life?
In my life thus far, in the 52 years thus far, yeah.
Whoa. Shimmity cricket. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I must be up into the 20s and maybe even 30s, I would say.
Come on. Really?
Yeah. When I was in Southern California, my mom and I moved every year.
Oh.
But Alex, you've moved around.
I'm going to say probably about 10, maybe.
Okay.
So,
We're not counting like college and stuff though, right?
Well, let's see.
Kind of temporary. It should count. Should it count? I don't know.
I'll say probably 8 or 9 for me.
And what do you think? Like, do you feel like you've benefited? I mean, was it hard or strange for you to move out west from where you, from your East Coast life up to that point?
Yeah. So, yeah, I most of those places that I'm talking about were in New York City proper. So I moved around New York City a few times. And then the last move I did was moving out here to Portland, because I think I just got to a part of my life and I was like, well, I lived in New York for basically my entire adult life since college. Do I want to be the kind of person who lives in one city for their entire life? Mm-hmm. And which is a perfectly valid, you know, I'm not criticizing that choice. I was just, did I want to do that? And I said, no, I don't. And so I, it was very weird picking up and moving to a totally different.
But why Portland? I assumed it was for like a job reason or something, but why Portland?
I'd visited here a few times. I have some family out here, and I think visiting them, that was a kind of like, huh. I was able to come out here like a couple of summers in a row to visit, and that's the best time to come to Portland. So I was like, this seems like a much mellower town than living in a, you know, cement urinal trough that is.
Oh, you mean my home where I'm going to live and die?
No, no, I meant those others.
The other street.
Yeah, yeah, the other one. They're next to you guys. So, right. So, you know, it's just different. I also feel like, I mean, like you said, Dean, you've lived there for a while. You've seen New York go through a lot of different
iterations,
you know, incarnations and whatnot. And to me, it felt like it was just changing a lot and not necessarily for, you know, in pleasant ways. But
no, I agree. And I have to remember, it's not my New York.
Right.
You know, it's not anybody's place, really. I mean, people like to own things and identify and relate in that way. And I understand that. But what I've come to truly understand is that it's a transitional place. It always has mm-hmm. and always will be. And that's what makes it exciting and interesting and new for a lot of people. And
it's not Cleveland.
It's not Cleveland. And they still have WoHop and La Caridad and the Russian Turkish bathhouse. And those are the three perennials for me.
It's true.
Well, the funny thing is I come out here to Portland and I'm just, all the people who live here are like, oh man, the city's really changing. It's really getting really mainstream and corporate and so on. So it's the same exact complaints about New York. Just
the same complaints ever.
So many people moving here. And so
big city complaints.
Yeah, that's the thing. If a city is good, people want to move there. That's there's plenty of crappy cities to live in if you want to move there where people aren't
moving.
Well,
I feel really bad because when I moved to Brooklyn 22 years ago, it probably wasn't as cool. And then I made it cool and it made everybody move here.
Oh, you're to blame.
Dean the Gentrifier Haskell.
That's
they call you.
That's my villain name. All right, so we're coming to the end here soon, I think, Josh.
Yeah.
In terms of the scenes.
So then we have this shot of the real Harvey walking down the street, and on the director's commentary. So the director's commentary has like everybody in the movie sitting in the room talking about it. So there's like the directors, there's Harvey, there's Joyce, Judah Friedlander, Paul Giamatti, and the real Toby Radloff and Danielle. So that's a lot of people commenting. And at this particular moment when Paul Giamatti, you know, turns into the real Harvey, Danielle says, he looks like a turtle. And then Toby said, he does. He looks like a turtle trying to come out of his shell.
Aw.
That should be in the movie. That should have been some, although it's implied visually.
Right.
Because remember, image is text too.
Yes. Thank you, Professor Haspiel.
You're welcome.
And again, I was struck by, so there's this moment now where Harvey's doing this voiceover and he's saying, sure, I'll lose the war eventually, but the goal is to win a few skirmishes along the way, right? And he's walking and they're filming him and you have to think they probably did multiple takes and multiple audio takes. And it's just, it strikes me so strange that Harvey Pekar, the man who basically invented autobiographical comics, telling his stories his way, choosing his artists, in control of like all processes, is now an actor in his own movie saying lines that somebody else wrote. And it's striking.
Well, the delivery of the lines felt authentic, so they might have had to work around how he would say it, or they might have said, well, this is the part of the movie where we need to convey this. What do you think, Harvey? So, again, I like to ask the directors, like, how much input did he have in the script, you know, at least the parts that he had to say. But in terms of acting, that might have been one take, my friend.
Not too much in there.
Oscar performance there of him walking.
But you never know. There's like extras could fall down behind him or something. Or like, you know, a bus could come by or a hamster could be making noises.
Terrorists could come
so
shoot up the side of the wall.
Sometimes they just have to.
An airplane could fall.
Anything.
So any other thoughts before we go to the final scene, which is the office party?
I'm good.
You're good? Okay. So
bring it home.
So yeah, then we have this final scene lit with Harvey sitting at his desk.
Well, before that, there's a close-up.
Yeah.
That tells us something. It's a close-up of a framed certificate that says Department of Veteran Affairs Service Award, Harvey Pekar.
Presented to Harvey L. Pekar.
That's right.
In appreciation of 25 years of dedicated service to the United States government.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Which I also find funny. He's not exactly the most patriotic citizen that I've seen, but he did that. He worked there for 25 years mm-hmm. as a file clerk, refusing promotions along the way, I read.
And
he wanted that job and no other job.
When the camera pans over to him sitting, the real Harvey Pekar sitting in the same chair and desk that Paul Giamatti's Harvey Pekar sat in.
Right.
I did wonder, is that really where he worked all those years? Is that the spot?
I was wondering that too, and I'm not quite sure because I know that there was some discussion earlier about they couldn't film some of the scenes in his actual office because it was undergoing renovation in the hospital, or there were some regulations about filming after 9/11, etc. And so the scene earlier in the film, I don't know if you remember it, Alex, that the jelly beans, lentils, and Lent scene where Judah Friedlander as Toby brings Harvey some jelly beans, and then the real Harvey and the real Toby cross paths with the actors playing them. It's a really cool scene, but it's obviously on a set because they walk off the set onto like a white screen studio background.
Right.
And that looks like this same set, but it's possible they just replicated it really well. But this appeared to me to be the actual place because there was that back room that all the people came out of who have the cake and everything. And that was such a great way to end the film for me because it was like a documentary of a very awkward office party, like all the awkward office parties that I've ever been to.
Well, I was going to say he's sitting there and he's kind of like, it's a few seconds that you feel time and you feel him looking at his desk and then you hear surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Toby Radloff, the real Toby Radloff, the real Danielle, the real Joyce come in among co-workers. And they have this cake with sparklers on it.
Sparklers.
And that's when I thought I recognized an artist, Mark Zingarelli, I think is also in that scene.
Oh, okay.
White-haired guy.
Huh.
Who's the guy who illustrated our movie year.
Which ends the last shot. So
right.
So you see this montage of Harvey smiling, eating cake, everyone kind of hanging out. I forget the tone of the music. It probably was celebratory in some way. Oh, because Toby actually sings for He's a Good Jolly Good Fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have this nice montage, eating cake, and finally ends on the three of them, Joyce, Danielle, and Harvey hugging.
Mm-hmm.
And you cut to a close-up of a new American Splendor comic called Our Movie Year. That's the cover is illustrated by Mark Zingarelli, which is why I think that was also him in the scene.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, and the real Toby made sure to give a shout-out to the actual co-workers who were in there. So one of them is Robert McNeil, who was documented in American Splendor Unsung Hero, the guy who served in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a 3-issue miniseries that Dark Horse put out, like, you know, predating all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some other coworkers, Michael Fullerton, Pam, Edward, Miguel, Annetta, and randomly Danielle's friend Rusty was in that scene. And they didn't mention Mark Zingarelli, but he could definitely have been there.
Yeah, and that was the end. That's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
So I did have a couple of questions to wrap it up, unless there's other notes about this last shot.
Yeah, my only other note, which I think I mentioned in my really quick setup, was that it was kind of cute that the cover of the Our Movie Year actually showed Sherry and Bob. The genius is behind this film.
But that cover is the book cover.
That's the actual cover of the book.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of cool that, and I assume it was purposeful, that they sort of made a little wave to the audience at the very end in the, because you never see them on screen even though you hear their voices.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a ton of work to put this movie together. I mean, I'm just in awe of the way that they constructed this movie and did all the research and found all these old stories and tied them all together, all these disparate stories, and made them into a narrative. So it's cool, you know, that they got to have a little wave at the end.
No, I thought that was great. And so I have a question for both of you.
Yes.
That I could also answer as well. But have you guys ever retired from a long job or vocation? I'm trying to deal with the themes of this ending scene here.
Retired?
The longest job I ever had was when I worked at Barnes & Noble. I was there for like 7 years and I didn't retire. I quit, but it was very unsatisfying. So,
did you have a retirement party or are you just out the door?
No, I was more or less just out the door. part of the reason I wanted to quit was that everyone I know who worked there was gone, and it was all a bunch of people. It was like what I was saying about New York. Everyone I knew was gone, and it was a bunch of people I didn't know. So I was like, eh. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Why? What about you? Do you have the story, Dean?
Well, the other part of the question is, when I thought of vocation, did you ever try to do something that you really had a passion for and then quit it or retire from it? Like, I don't know, if you played piano or something like that, was there anything you ever wanted to do and you decided to not pursue it? But when you think about it, that was something like an alternative Alex Robinson.
So wait, something I retired from or something I never did at all?
Well, something you had a passion for that maybe you decided to not pursue. Like in my case, I'll use an example. I do comic books, right? Mm-hmm. And I've written some plays and I like storytelling. But one of my regrets, possibly, and I'm thinking in the future here on my deathbed, if I could think about it, would be that I didn't get to make a movie. And I still am young enough to maybe make a movie, and I love film, but I love movies enough to know that that's something I really, really, really want to do, but I haven't done it. And maybe it's for whatever reasons, that's a vocation I'm not going to pursue. Was there anything like that in your life?
There was a time where I got into chess when I was in my 20s. And I got a bunch of chess books, and I imagined, like, oh, you know what? Someday when I, quote unquote, retire, I'm going to really learn how to play chess. And then there was one time where I was moving, and I was like, I'm never going to do that. So I got rid of all the chess books. So,
well, that's something you can still pick up, hopefully, but that's an interesting answer, because it's about strategy too. That's a game of strategy. That's really interesting.
But also, theoretically, my mental facilities are probably not getting better. They're I'm probably getting like fuzzier and harder to learn things. So, you know,
you could play underwater chess.
Oh, there you go.
Is that a real thing?
You have to make sure your phone has a waterproof case.
That's right.
Weren't you, Alex, was it you guys were talking on Star Wars Minute about some version of chess where you play and make a move and then you have to go and get into a boxing ring with your opponent and box them for like a minute and then go back to chess?
I don't remember that specifically, but I kind of do a memory dump after every episode, so I don't remember anything we say on the show.
I feel like one of your shows, that was like a thing, that there was like chess boxing.
Huh. I guess it would kind of be a leveler, you know, like it would be like doing the pentathlon or something.
Yeah, like how good a chess strategist are you after you've been punched in the head 10 times, you know?
I like it. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I thought you would like it.
What about you, Josh? You ever retire something or decide to not pursue a
vocation?
I feel like
I've made a policy in my normal quote-unquote work life that I never stayed at a job for longer than like 2 years at the most. And then I became basically a freelancer when I was like 30. Mm-hmm. And so, no, I never stayed anywhere long enough to retire.
Me too.
I don't imagine I'll ever retire.
I never had a really, really long job, you know, and I knew that just because I wanted to make comics. I wanted to be a freelancer.
Yeah.
But weirdly enough, I've had inklings of retiring from comics. The idea of retiring from comics.
We've talked about that, or at least from drawing comics.
Yeah.
Right?
It's in my head.
Yeah. Hmm.
We'll see what happens.
Are you officially announcing your retirement?
No. I mean, I think ultimately you can't really retire from it. I just don't like to draw, Alex. I just have a tough time sitting down and getting started. Once I finish something, I'm okay with it. Like, I don't love it, but at least I produce something, and I love drawing narrative. And I think ultimately maybe the future would be trying to find that real shortcut, that real shorthand of drawing, like, not necessarily talking heads, because then I might as well just write a play or, you know, use my phone camera to shoot a little scene or something. But, you know, I still think about, well, why is it a comic? Why is it drawn? How do you earn the next panel? You know, and maybe I put too much pressure on myself because of that. And it may not be even noticeable in the work, but I know that's part of my struggle with it. So I don't know if I want that much stress in my life for something that should just be innate, because comics can be quite innate. We've been doing this since we were kids. And so, yeah, I think I'll always kind of do it, at least on a bar napkin or something, you know, like some kind of comic. But the construction of it is getting a little bit more and more of a struggle, because you want to kind of, I don't know, not that I'm going to go down Alex Toth territory. And for those who don't know who Alex Toth is, he was a guy who was a master craftsman of comics that almost tried to outdo himself with every story. Alas, most of his stories are not memorable in terms of their literary value or, you know, entertainment value, but you would look at his work and just be astounded by the way he thought in pictures. And again, I'm not going down that direction, but there must be some kind of balancing act that I haven't figured out yet.
I think once, like you said, once you get away from the time clock aspect of it, you might be able to find what got you into it, you know what I mean, without that pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And be able to just tell the story that you want to tell, like when you were a kid and you would sit down and write your own stories and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
I think it's a big difference.
You mean before inking and erasing and editing?
And yeah, exactly.
Craft, you know, just when it was just like, put it down, see what happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you never want to be a hack in your own chosen field. You know, it's like, you don't want to ever have that feeling of like, oh my God, I got to go sit at the drawing table and put in the 8 hours again just to get this thing done.
So I have two more questions, one specific to Alex and one specific to you, and then we can wrap it up.
Okay.
Which is, Alex, which of your comics closely resembles memoir?
It's a tough one. I would say it's a, because all my stories are kind of like quasi-autobiographical or I guess I'll say the last one I did, Our Expanding Universe. I think that that was the most recent book. Okay. And I think that was the most, yeah, I'll say that one.
And right. That one has to do with the choice to not have kids and having friends who have kids.
Yeah. One of the main characters is wrestling with the idea of having kids. And because basically what happened is I had a bunch of friends. They all had kids and then they weren't my friends anymore. So just, you know, not because
you shunned them.
Yeah. Because I was just like, that's it. You're dead to me now. Enjoy your life with your kid. No, it's just because, you know, as we all know, once you become a parent, it radically alters your life. And so I don't begrudge them that. But, you know, it was sad for me to just be like, well, you know, I guess that's it. Mm-hmm. So that's what the book that was a lot inspired by, that kind of me wrestling with those feelings.
And that perfectly transitions into my Josh question, which is, Josh, how did having Phoebe change your creativity and your life?
I became an opera singer.
No, you didn't. Did it change your time management? Like, what did it do to have a child?
Yeah, I mean, I guess just in a general level, because I can't say anything specific like, oh, I all of a sudden had this whole new outlook and insight into this beautiful thing we call life.
Mm-hmm.
It's more mundane than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think time management and my, you know, understanding that there are fewer hours in the day to noodle and to figure stuff out. And you just have to, like, the time that you have to sit at the drawing table is very precious and you have to be extra productive during that time. And I think that, you know, I definitely have produced a lot more pages since Phoebe was born than probably all the years before. But I think that's also just a confluence of I found some success, you know, and
right.
People were actually buying my books as opposed to me just trading them with other cartoonists.
And did having a daughter influence the kind of work you pursue, the stories you want to tell?
Not specifically, especially because, you know, I tend to try to find stories that of other people's experiences and that are related to things that are going on in the world currently outside of my own. I mean, there have been some stories I've thought about doing that are related to my own experiences as a father, but I haven't found that I was compelled to do them as much as other people's stories that I found just like much more important to tell.
Right.
But that could happen. Yep. A project that I'm working on now that involves like school shooting and stuff. Obviously, that's something that I'm very connected to on a personal level because my daughter is in school and getting to the age where those things happen to kids that age.
Mm-hmm.
Though fortunately, not so far in New York, knock on wood.
Cool. And Alex, what are you working on right now as we wrap this up?
Well, it's funny. I have not been working on comics very much lately. Like I said, I've been doing more illustration-y type stuff. I got an iPad Pro for Christmas last year, and it totally revolutionized my artistic inclinations. I've never really worked. I've always worked on pen and paper before. This is the first time I've really been comfortable working digitally, and I'm especially enjoying working in color and stuff, which is something I've not been able to do in comics generally. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I've been seeing some of those on your Instagram, and they're really cool.
Yeah, I post them on the social networks and whatnot.
Yeah.
I need those likes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have one final question, too.
Uh-oh.
Which might be a quick one. Alex, if Harvey Pekar were a Star Wars character, what do you imagine he would be?
Well, the first thing I thought of is the bartender who yells at Luke that the droids aren't allowed in the cantina.
Yes.
Just because he has that kind of surly demeanor.
He's almost a spitting image. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the first thing that pops into my mind is he'd be C-3PO's CPU.
Whoa.
Wait.
He's a filing system.
Wow. You see like multiple levels there. Harvey Pekar is a filing system.
But he's also an observer.
He's not a system. He's a man.
But C-3PO and R2-D2 basically are our avatars for the story, right?
Avatar with...
Oh, you're going to make a James Cameron joke.
Don't do it.
That was the first, you know, the filing clerk, the guy who conveys the stories, tells the stories, owns the stories.
Right,
you know.
Right.
Yeah.
To me, those are the characters, right? Like somehow he would be involved in that way, you know? Or maybe one of the robots that we see for a second, we're like, what the hell was that character?
Yeah.
Maybe that was Harvey Pekar.
Yeah.
Although I really want to read C-3PO's autobiographical comics now about
having
to do some mundane job or something.
I had this red arm and nobody seemed to notice or even know that it was me.
Or to honor, in a weird way, Rutger Hauer, who just passed away at age 75, the things that C-3PO has seen.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. Well... Alex, thank you so much for suffering through this.
Thank you, Alex.
it was a lot of fun.
I don't know how many movies that have been inspired to do the movie by minute treatment by your incredible Star Wars minute have taken on films that don't have the action and the laser blasts and pop culture, you know, place that Star Wars and Godfather and all the other movies. And this one definitely is not the one that would probably spring to mind as doing the movie by minute treatment. So, you know, we're doing a little bit longer scene by scene and you've been a real trooper and hanging in there with us a little bit longer than we originally threatened. So thank you so much.
Oh, no, it was fun. I enjoyed talking about Harvey Pekar and American Splendor and yeah, I love when people do more cultish kind of, non-blockbustery kind of stuff. So,
well, that's this.
I think someone was doing the My Dinner with Andre minute.
No.
Which I've never seen, actually, the movie,
gosh.
It's just two guys sitting in a restaurant talking all the time.
Yeah. One, and they would do that minute by minute?
That's a real challenge.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think they might have given up on it, but I'm not 100% sure. So check your local listings.
Didn't Andy Warhol shoot a 7-hour movie
of a guy sleeping?
Or windows of like the Empire State Building or something?
Oh, yeah, I think so too.
Windows.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Try to do that one.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Alex, thank you again. And
thank you.
Thank you.
You have a real fan in me. I just want to say, when I discovered your show about 3 years ago, that just changed my whole understanding of podcasts. And I went through every episode of Star Wars Minute. I think at the time you guys were doing Phantom Menace, but at the same time I like caught up to Phantom Menace and then I started like going back to the original Star Wars. So I was listening to both seasons at the same time. And that is definitely, you know, what set me down this crazy path of trying to do this movie and roping Dean in on this crazy idea. And so thank you.
Well, I apologize.
Yeah. Dean might not thank you, but I'm thanking you.
You have a warm pat on the shoulder.
Oh, thank you. Ugh. I was wondering what that warm pat was.
It was a wet, warm pat.
All right. Well, that about wraps up this episode. Remember that you can visit us at scenebyscenepodcast.com and Scene by Scene on Facebook, where you can join the discussion, subscribe, download past episodes, read up on the show, and check out our work, including all things Harvey Pekar, and buy merch from our store. So until next time, this is Josh Neufeld.
And Dean Haspiel.
Oh, and Alex Robinson.
On Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean.